runners at first and third. The pitch. White hits a high fly ball, shallow center field. Pete Crow Armstrong makes the catch, and the Cubs win the ball game. It's a save for Daniel Palencia. Two straight wins over Atlanta.
They were two straight wins over Atlanta, thanks to Pat Hughes and Ron Coomer on the call. This is Raheem and Harris on 670 The Score. Kevin Alcantara, part of that game as well. And Daniel Palencia, as you heard, picks up save number 22 of the year. We go out to our Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa app today. And that is where we are joined by Cubs general manager Carter Hawkins. And during our conversations with Carter, we highlight the work of Paws Chicago, whose mission is to build no-kill communities, to end overpopulation of homeless animals, and to transform animal welfare. Carter, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think we have to start with the number one question, which unfortunately I feel like we've had to ask too many times recently. What is the latest regarding Kyle Tucker?
Yeah, not much new from last night. You know, he had tightness in his calf and kind of more from a preventative measure, took himself out of the game. But, you know, we feel like there's a really good shot this is a short-term thing, and, you know, we'll see how he presents today. He's not going to play today, and we have an off day the next day. So give him a little rest and, you know, hopefully get him back in the lineup here soon.
Given what happened the last time he had an injury, and I know that was more something we discovered later, does that alter at all the conversations you and Kyle, the medical staff, have about how to deal with this and get him in the best shape for the playoffs, which is what this is ultimately about?
You know, I think from a process standpoint, we try to be as consistent as we can. You know, when a guy gets hurt, it's, you know, can you play with this? How much is this taken away from, you know, your current abilities? And then, you know, what's the risk of continuing to play? And, you know, on this one, it's, you know, obviously a high risk if, you know, if something were to get worse. And so we want it to be on the safe side. And, you know, we feel like this is, you know, going to be something that, you know, shouldn't affect him too long. But, you know, we'll really see how he approaches today and, you know, kind of take it day by day.
Well, and Carter, you also have a couple of good, I don't know that they're problems necessarily, when you've called up people in the outfield who have performed in the stead of other veterans. You know, I consider Kevin Alcantara yesterday, what we saw out of Owen Casey. Let's start with the one who is here in Alcantara. You know, what do you think about his abilities and a plan, you know, should something happen where you need more people in the outfield?
I mean, it's definitely an area we feel good about our upper level depth in, and you see that with Kevin, you see that with Owen. You know, with Kevin, he can play a really solid center field, so that gave us an opportunity to give Pete a few days off, just to let him rest and reset a little bit as we get ready for this last push. But he's an exciting player, you know, Kevin is, and, you know, a lot of energy, can hit the ball a long way, you know, a great defender, and, you know, really can do a lot of interesting things on the baseball field that are exciting to watch, and, you know, I think he'll be part of our lineup for years to come.
With Kevin playing center field, and obviously he is a substitute in the outfield specifically, is this a situation where we're going to see more of a platoon situation because of Pete's struggles against left-handed pitching?
I don't believe so. I mean, Pete is so valuable to this team, you know, on both sides of the ball, but certainly on defense. And so, you know, I think this is really just about giving Pete a couple of days to reset. But it's hard to imagine not wanting to put him in the lineup as much as we possibly can.
We also were encouraged by the performance out of Owen Casey. What did you see out of him when he was with the big league club, and what could the future hold for him this year? I'm sorry, I had to be more specific there.
Both. You know, really encouraging, right? I mean, there's two things about Owen. One, you know, he was in AAA for a decent amount of time and performing really, really well. And it can be very easy to get stale in that situation, but he didn't. He continued to improve, continued to put his focus in the right places. And when he got his opportunity, I thought we had some really professional at bats. He was extremely encouraging. We feel like he can handle, you know, September baseball, October baseball. We wanted to get him back to AAA just to be able to get back into the groove. You know, it can be tough playing that bench role, but definitely encouraged. And, you know, he could be a guy that's, you know, getting some leverage at bats. And, you know, I think Kevin, Owen, all of those guys, Moises are all in the mix for that. And we'll see how it all plays out as the season ends.
So I'm assuming when it comes to going back down to Iowa, that it was about getting at bats rather than staying on the big league club and just absorbing that experience and the time.
Yeah, you're always weighing that. But I think at the end of the day, you know, guys need to actually see 95-mile-per-hour fastballs coming at him. You know, we can only hit on our pitching machine so much. And, you know, the ability for Kevin to come up and spell Pete just for a little bit, it all kind of made sense at this juncture. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see Owen back up in the big leagues this year.
Carter, I know you probably know that your comments about this team this year as far as the trade deadline and what some people saw as a lack of aggression to go out and get bigger players that could help you this year, you talked about worrying about not just this year's team, but the team from 2032. After hearing maybe the blowback from some people, do you revise those statements or do you think you were misunderstood? How would you characterize that?
Yeah, I appreciate you guys not going to that one on question one or two. So I was ready for it. Yeah. No, look, I mean, we talk a ton publicly, you know, both Jed and I, about always keeping an eye on the present and an eye on the future. I put a number to that. And that created some blowback, right, putting some specific number. But I think that backlash just really shows how invested this team is, or excuse me, invested the fans are towards this team. And, you know, I appreciate that. The players appreciate that. You know, we, both Jed and I, appreciate it, even when people are telling us to go pound sand. You know, our focus here is to try to get these, you know, these teams into the playoffs in Wrigley year over year. And that's where we'll put our energy. And, you know, certainly appreciate that we have a fan base that cares so much.
How do you measure that specific action at the trade deadline versus what you were willing to give up in the offseason for only one guaranteed year of Kyle Tucker?
Meaning, how do we – oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, so Kyle obviously is a player that you're getting for a full year. Obviously, we've put a lot into this team to be the competitive playoff team that we are right now. So that certainly is – part of the calculus, right? You know, 1 or 2 months versus, you know, versus 6 months, I think is a big thing. And then what those wins ultimately, where they ultimately put your team and the impact that you think they're going to have. And we felt like that putting a bat like Kyle Tucker for 6 months and, you know, hopefully 7 months onto our team was going to have a massive impact. And therefore we're willing to do a massive deal.
Yeah. I think, Carter, it was last year that I asked you when it was known or at least reported that the Cubs had gone over the competitive balance tax number. Then I was like, well, why don't you just ball all the way out? You know, just if you're going to go, why don't you just go all the way? I am a meatball in that respect. But I think the response you had at the time was, you know, it's still like buying a house. You can get one of your luxury items, but you can't maybe get the entire block, for example. So I say that asking this question, you know, what was stopping you from even trading some of the names that we talked about here? I think that's something we discussed previously, but in this context, I think it might be good to revisit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the names that we're talking about here are helping our team win right now and are helping our team win in the competitive window. And, you know, certainly guys that are not only going to help us in 2025, but 26, 27, 28, and then so forth. So the idea of, you know, trading one of those guys, you know, I don't want to get into specific trade apps, but I can tell you guys that are performing at an elite level and we are going to have for a long time are the guys that we're getting asked about. And to trade those guys, their 5 years of those guys for 2 months of another guy that may not be as good as him, just doesn't make any sense. And so it really came down to that. It was a pretty easy decision at the end of the day.
I know that Jameson Taillon threw a bull session on Monday. Michael Soroka, he threw yesterday, and they say his velocity was up. What can you tell us about Soroka's status as one of the guys you did go out and get at the deadline?
Yeah, really encouraging. Live VP for him. His velocity was up. He was up to 96. Obviously, we need to continue to get him stretched out a little bit, but, you know, hopefully he'll be a weapon for us towards the end of September. Role to be determined, just depending on kind of what our needs are, but I think kind of, you know, at a minimum, I feel like he's a guy that can help get right-handers out of our bullpen, and we'll see if we can, you know, continue to extend him out to get more outs as well. But I'm definitely excited about the chance for, you know, a little bit of a reload here towards the end of September.
And then, Carter, that said, let's stay on a bit of starting pitching. You know, we've complimented Cade Horton many times, especially since the trade deadline. What do you think about his performance since then?
It's been really impressive. I mean, after that, you know, that first change up to Juan Soto in his first start, it's kind of like, all right, you know, this guy has some toughness. This guy has some grit. He is not scared, and he has showed that every outing he's been out here. And, you know, he got punched in the face a little bit in Houston and came right back and, you know, just continued to show his stuff and show that he could compete at this level. And now he's in the Rookie of the Year conversation, and it's just an impressive job by him, impressive job by our player development department to, you know, help continue to have him get better year over year and with our major league club to be able to help him assimilate here. But he's definitely one of our top guys and one of the top guys in the league, and sure lucky to have him for as long as we do.
Well, you gave an encouraging statement earlier about when we might be able to see Owen Casey. You know, we have a bit of a timeline now with Michael Soroka, for example. What do you want people to know? What do you want fans to know about the team approach for this month of September as you get ready for what should hopefully be a fun October to watch?
Yeah, what I'd like people to know is it's a little bit boring, right? Is that these guys every day, they show up trying to win today in the same way that they tried to win in April, in the same way that they tried to win in May, and focusing on preparing for each individual pitcher and each relief pitcher and, you know, making sure that our defense is positioned well and just focusing on all the little things to try to give us the best chance to win every game. And we stack those on top of each other. And we've done it 80 times now in early September, and we're going to try to do it, you know, hopefully, you know, 23 more or however many more games we have. But it's a very professional approach, which I think has enabled them to ride some of the waves here a little bit. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we're going to be really happy where this team ends up and hopefully make some waves in the playoffs.
Back to Cade Horton quickly. I know he's a rookie. He's already pitched more innings professionally than he ever has in his career. He's lined up to make five more starts, including today. Is there a cap at all on his innings? How are you monitoring that? Because he's the best pitcher you have had since the All-Star break, one of the best pitchers in the league.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that we're thinking about. There's no hard caps on any of our pitchers. There's, you know, some old, you know, old rules about, you know, 20%, 30%, and, you know, injury rates. And, you know, when you actually do the research on it, those are pretty well debunked. But we do know that every time you throw a baseball, you have the risk of injury. And the more you risk injury, the better chance you are going to get injured. And so we're monitoring, you know, not only, you know, workloads, but also the stuff, how guys' deliveries look, how they're looking in the weight room, their body composition, all of those different things. And, you know, we're definitely going to, you know, err on the side of not trying to redline him here as we get closer to the playoffs. But at the same time, there's no cap on him, and he's put his body and himself in a really good position to be able to extend himself a little bit here.
Carter Hawkins, thank you so much for joining us today, and Raheem and Harris on The Score.
Thanks, Carter.
Appreciate it, guys.
That was Carter Hawkins, and during our conversations with the Cubs general manager, we highlight the work of PAWS Chicago, whose mission is to build no-kill communities to end overpopulation of homeless animals and to transform animal welfare, which is always a wonderful cause.
A great cause.
Yeah. Some little furry friend out there might need you.
Not me, but someone else, yes.
You never know. You can give somebody a good life, that's for sure. We will move to football next. Mike Florio, the creator and editor-in-chief of Pro Football Talk. You know we're going to ask him about Micah Parsons coming to the North. There's a lot of other NFL stuff to discuss as well. That is next here on Raheem and Harris on The Score.
You know him, you love him. Number 57, Olin Krutz.
Man,
happy to be here.
Olin gives us football legitimacy, Bears legitimacy, offensive line legitimacy, and I'll go ahead and say it. It'll be the first time I say it. Center position legitimacy. You know what I mean? Like, my career is well known.
Yes.
It's well known, but Olin played at a higher level in more important situations than my 4 years with the Mighty Sequoias.
Yeah.
I think.
He actually has talked about how...
Well, a lot. I've heard this story.
But I'm giving it to you. I'm conceding now.
It reminds me of, like, at home, I'll start talking and my 13-year-old daughter, Abby, will be like, we know, Dad. You're the greatest center of all time. You did everything. You played for the Bears. And it's amazing, though. She'll say verbatim what I've said, which probably means I've said it too much.
No, you know, not at all. But they listen. That's a good thing.
Well, and that's what home is supposed to do. I remember one night after a rock show with the band, right? I'm like making the bed for my mother-in-law who's sleeping over. And I say to my wife, you think Mick Jagger's making a bed right now? And she's like, I think Mick Jagger makes a little more and hires people to make a bed. I'm like, all right, good call.
It's actually an excellent point.
It really is.
It's great to have Olin here as we kick off the season. Games start tonight. We will carry Thursday Night Football. It's going to be awesome because the Cubs are off today. So we've got Thursday Night Football. There's also Friday Night Football. There'll be college football on Saturday, Sunday, and then the dessert. Then Monday night, it is Vikings at Bears. And we get to see what Ben Johnson is all about. Olin, let's go all the way back because we have a group of people here that may not have heard you when the hire happened. There's obviously the person in their car or at their desk that wants to talk Bears. When Ben Johnson was hired, mm-hmm. what did you think it signified?
It signified that the hottest candidate wanted to come coach the Chicago Bears, which there was some worry about, right? There was some worry that he was not interested in the Chicago Bears because of their history with their franchise and the things they go through. And to be fair, we haven't won a lot around here lately, right? And people are worried about coming here. And a lot of coaches have come here and they've been geniuses and they've left idiots. Right, the building has done that to a lot of guys. So people are worried about that, right? When you come here, and I had some insight into talking to some guys who knew him, and they were a little worried about that. And that was just early on in the process. And then all of a sudden, he came up, he took the job. Now, $13 million a year helps, right? I mean, the money helps to come here and try to change the path that we've been on with quarterbacks and offense and getting things going in the right direction. And I've said many times on these radio waves that the last time we won a playoff game, I was playing. And I'm old, right? I'm 401k is coming for me right around the corner. And, you know, my son just graduated college. So they got to start winning football games up there at Halas Hall. I'm always interested, Lawrence and Speaks, when people say to me, man, why do you sound like you doubt the Bears so much? And I just print up the 10-year history, the last 10 years of their records, and I say, well, why do you trust them so much, right? So to have a guy like him, who you guys know, he wasn't taking certain jobs. He was going through a very thorough process of checking on what was in the building, who he wanted to coach, and who he wanted to be, and where he thought he could win. And just him picking the Chicago Bears meant to me that what he saw, who knows what he saw, he liked. And that's positive.
I'm really glad that you brought it to that level right away, because that's a reminder of the realities. And you mentioned talking to people who knew him. And as that process went on, those people that knew him, and eventually we heard it from him, were way more impressed than they expected to be. Because like all these years that we've been talking Bears, when you were playing, before you were playing, here on the Score for 30 plus years, and in the last 5 or 10, go higher. What about the front office? Go higher. What about ownership? They don't want a strong coach. All that. It seems like Kevin Warren convinced ownership to get the man as the coach and let him be the face of it. And that's a big deal, isn't it?
Huge. Huge. And it's well said by you. And Kevin Warren, Ryan Poles, this is the new leadership at Halas Hall, right? And whatever Ben Johnson saw from them, he liked in the direction they were moving in. And they re-signed Ryan Poles to a contract to marry him to Ben Johnson. And some of that is like, wow, man, you don't got to do much to get a new contract at Halas Hall. It's your first reaction, right? It's your first like, but you go out and you get, you know, Caleb Williams, who people say is a generational quarterback. He's the number one pick. You sign the hottest coaching candidate in the NFL. Everybody wanted Ben Johnson, right? And when you watch him schematically on film for a guy like me, watch him call plays, watch him do matchups, watch him attack people. You know what? He's really, really good at getting his offense to do the things it has to do to score points and attack defenses. He's really good at that.
Have you seen some stuff in camp that lets you know, staying in the big picture, that it's Ben's show, that it's Ben, you know, kind of in charge of things, whether that's personnel or the way things are run, that he's as empowered as a coach needs to be?
Well, first of all, a new coach is always empowered in the building, right? They have to start to transition to what he believes and the kind of players that he wants, right? And who he wants to coach and who he wants in the building to move in the direction that he wants to go in. So obviously, early on, it is Ben Johnson's show. Now, him and Ryan Poles have to work together. Kevin Warren's a part of it. As you guys know, buildings win championships, right? Like, everyone's always turning over the same spots, right? The head coach, the players. Eventually, the building there has to win championships, and it starts and hopefully grows from Ben Johnson's leadership.
You gave us a bar when you talked about the farther away you are from the football, the farther away you are from football. Mm-hmm. And it's seared into our minds, and it's changed the way that we think.
The farther you get away from the
football. Do it, Danny.
The farther you get away from the football, the farther you get away from football.
Mm-hmm. All he did was take out a the. Well, he just took out an article.
It's pretty great.
That's a Washington education right
there. So I think about that a lot when, and Olin has opened up my mind to think more about the offensive line when it comes to football, which is great because we should. That's where the game's won and lost. So now you have a lot of money being paid guard to guard, which is great. They needed to upgrade those spots. We all like Darnell Wright. Solid. They're walking in the left tackle and walking to the season with the left tackle position just being figured out yesterday. How do you feel about what they did at that position, and what does it mean that you then drafted someone in what, the 54th pick or whatever Ozzie Trapillo was, to be a swing tackle? That's a strange allocation of assets that you got going on there.
Yeah, and it started with Ryan Pose and the general manager, Ian Cunningham, the assistant general manager, right? And their scouting department, as you guys have known, anybody who listens to me on airwaves, and I've been speaking in homes here, I have a lot of questions. And the way they designed the O-line and who they decided to pick. And they did throw a lot of money. Dahlman, you know, they gave the number one center in free agency, Dahlman, some money. They signed Joe. They trade for Joe Tooney. They signed Jonah Jackson, right? They drafted Darnell Wright. There is a lot of assets there in the offensive line, right? And then on the other side, Javon Dexter, Grady Jackson, Billings, Montez Sweat. But so it's just there's a lot of guys to draft, right? There was Ursary out of Minnesota there the year before. They took Romo Dunze instead of Olu Fashanu. I would have took, obviously, I'm an O-liner. I would have took one, the left tackle. Right, I always want to build my left tackle. If you watch the Eagles, if you watch them play, if you see the way they design their team, it's like they're waiting for a street fight to break out, and they just ask themselves, will we win the street fight? And they would, right? And they take O-linemen and D-linemen year after year, and they stack those positions because you're going to need those guys late in the year to win. And you know, Braxton Jones is a question mark. I will say this. If you have the number one pick in the draft, if you have a head coach making $13 million, if the inside of your offensive line is making all that money, if you drafted a receiver in the first round, if you gave DJ more money, if you drafted Luther Burden, if you drafted Coastin Loveland, a tight end, and drafted Cole Kmet in the second round, if it doesn't work, it's not Braxton Jones' fault. Those guys are not making them better. Let me give you an example. On Twitter, everybody talked about the one play where Braxton Jones let the linebacker blitz. He didn't slide in and pick him up. That is his guy. It's called a dual protection. He has two guys. He takes the most dangerous of the two guys. So it's a five-man to slide away from him. First of all, I wouldn't slide away from Braxton Jones with all the money. I'd slide to him. First, here's what you can do. And I saw even the old Bear quarterback Chase Daniels posted, if you want to go on Twitter, he posted and talked about how it should have been a touchdown, but Braxton didn't do his job. The great quarterbacks walk up and say, Braxton, that guy's coming. Make sure your eyes are on him. Because why? I'm the number one pick in the draft. I have to make the guy making $500,000 a year better. I have to make him better. I know that. If I see that he has the hardest job on the offense at that moment, it is in my job to make him a better football player. I have to walk up and say, look, we're signing the line. You have those two guys. It looks to me like he's coming. Take him first. I'll negotiate in the end.
Can't imagine Caleb being ready to do that.
I can't. He's in second year.
You think so?
Yeah, he's got Ben Johnson, right? He's got all these assets there.
Okay, but
these guys. He finally got Pete someone, from what I heard, someone had to teach him how to watch film, right? That's what I heard last year. So I don't know. Like, as from a football guy, there's still some things I hear, I get confused. Right? When I'm watching, okay, yes, that is Braxton's job. If I'm the center in that position, I lean over, I say, Braxton, make sure you're watching that guy. Right? Like, that guy looks like he's coming to me. And he needs a silent count as Kansas City Chiefs. It's a tough game.
Well, that's interesting. So Olin says he ought to be ready to do that. Mm-hmm. That leads well into this little bit of tape that we wanted to play for you. This is from Drew Dahlman, the news center, when asked earlier in the week about his relationship with Caleb, mm-hmm. who's going to be helping who, how they're going to work together on identifying certain things maybe in the pass rush. Here's a little Q&A with Drew Dahlman.
Drew, since you got here, there's been kind of talk of how you could take some things off Caleb's plate to help him play faster. What are some of those things that you think you've been able to kind of alleviate that's going to allow him to be at an optimal level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just without getting into any kind of scheme specifics or anything like that, we've done a really good job of communicating with each other and letting each other know like what's helpful, what's not helpful, what kind of things he really likes to hear from me and what things we need to hear from him. And so that's always been really good, kind of learning the flow of information at the line of scrimmage. And then just the offense as a whole runs really well when all of us are communicating. And so that's been a focus, is like the O-line relaying everything we need to know, and then the quarterback relaying back and all that. So I feel like that's been really improving, and it's been good.
So he doesn't want to give it up. And there's another part of it where he's like, I don't want to talk about that because it's too much scheme. So I kind of like that he's protecting his quarterback and protecting the relationship. But what do you hear when you hear a guy not want to give it up and saying it's the whole offensive line's job, that kind of thing?
Yeah, he's actually saying what we just talked about, right? He's saying, what do we need from you there? I'm in silent cadence. I cannot help the left tackle, right? If the quarterback's inside, when the offensive line is like – people have to understand, when you're on the road and it's silent count, a lot of the stuff, the communication goes out the window. Hmm. The quarterback is basically in charge. He's the only guy who can change protections, see things, let everyone know what might be coming, what might not be coming. I was just watching, Ben Johnson and the Lions averaged 31 points, right, against the Vikings last year. So watching how did they get that done? Jared Goff's doing a lot of that. He's doing a lot of redirection. He's taking a lot of hits, getting the ball out. He's doing a nice job negotiating Flores, who... he guy's insane with the stuff he brings. But what you hear there is, what do we need from Caleb? That may be something we need, right? Like just – and Caleb, that's what preseason is for. You learn that. Hmm. You know, in that moment, hey man, remember, five-man protection. By five-man protection, I mean everyone else is out in routes. There's only five guys blocking, right? The offensive line is the only guys who have blocking responsibilities. So the running back is not going to block the linebacker. So now the backside tackle mostly in a bubble. That don't go too far, but he has two guys. You know that as a quarterback. If you think that linebacker's coming, walk up and tell him. Your number one job is to protect yourself. That's your number one job. You can blame the fifth round pick tackle if you want, right? You can do that. That's up to people. But like, I always live by this: who much is given, much is expected. Right, and just like in any business, right? Like in Odyssey, Mitch Rosen probably makes a good amount of money.
He does.
Yeah, a lot is expected.
How much, Mitch? This is a good time to announce it.
Playing the hits.
a lot is expected, and he's got to do a lot, right? He's got to get up early in the morning, get all the shows organized, and make sure everyone's doing what they got to do. Same thing in a football building, right? Like that's what they're talking about. That's what Dalman is talking about. What do we need from him? And Caleb's telling Dalman, this is what I need from you. Right, but now you got – here's another thing that you could throw in there. Joe Tooney's not playing that game. Joe may tell him. Right, now you got another guy there who much is given, much is expected. Right, and he knows blitz is coming. He knows his tackle's got a dual responsibility. He may tell him. See, a lot of guys on that field now who are paid a lot and have a lot to do, and you got a coach who is a lot is expected of.
Whenever I hear people talk about – Caleb, and I mentioned the idea of, man, I would love it if he could play like Jared Goff. People get mad at me, Olin. They're like, well, he's better. And I was like, well, hold on. Like, Jared Goff was also one of one. Like, he was the number one pick overall as well. And you look at his production, especially with Ben Johnson, even though I think Caleb might be a little bit more athletically gifted, I know that Jared Goff can run an offense and kind of do what he's asked to do. How long should it take for a guy like Caleb, who is in his college career, going all the way back to high school, was probably the best player on the field. Then in college, he had to do a lot of hero stuff because he was the best player on his team. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to get someone who succeeded doing it that way to be like, hey, when you get to the top of the drop, ball needs to come out? Right. How difficult is that to get a quarterback to understand?
He's got great arm talent, right? And he is an amazing athlete. And the way he can throw the ball around the field is, like, he's second to none. I mean, the thing is amazing what he does. How hard is it to get someone to run an NFL offense, see everything they need to see, make everyone around them better, give the tips, get everything going? Obviously, we've all seen over the years, it's extraordinarily hard, right? It's extraordinarily hard to do. Even in the NFL right now, how many guys would you say can do it? Right, like it's like, are you
nine?
I mean,
14
at the most. At the most,
I was
right?
gonna say six.
Yeah, at the most.
I'll go back to nine.
Just
fight
really
for nine.
Really tough. Being a quarterback in the NFL is a really hard job, right? So, but can he do it? How long should we expect the way? Look, I'm gonna watch him this year with Ben Johnson as his coach. We all heard it was all Eberflus' fault last year, from what I understand. That's all I hear about. So I'm always interested when there's a million millionaires in the building. They all point to one guy.
He was pretty bad, though.
Right? That's what you hear, right? You weren't in the building, right? That's what we hear from
people in the building.
People in the building, the people who
are all still kept in the building. Job by throwing him nicely under the bus, right? So it's fine. It's just always fascinating to me when it's like all 30 millionaires over here and everybody's like, it was his fault.
You're saying we bought it?
Yeah, listen, bought a little too much? I couldn't do my job because of him. I just don't like I Lawrence, I'm going to do my job.
Now we're back to Mitchell.
No matter what, right? So it's going to be interesting as we go here with Ben Johnson and Caleb Williams and Declan Doyle and all the guys they have in that building to help him develop, help him process information, have him surrounded him with the right people to help him learn how to be a pro. I go through, when I got here, my idea of football was just to hit anybody I could hit. Just attack everybody all day long and just eventually that would win me a job. I like to say violence is a skill, right? And I think that people who are violent, they naturally violent, you can see it on film, and eventually that pops to a coach, right? Like they want to see that violence. But I was competing with a very good center, Casey Wigman, and I think people a long time ago might have remembered. He played a long time in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey would not make a mistake. He wouldn't. He wouldn't mentally make a mistake. Every time I stood up to leave the room, he was studying his book. So I sat my ass down and studied my book. But to beat him out, I had to learn how to not make mistakes, make the right calls, do the right things on a football field. And I heard Mark Sanchez the other day said that when he first got in the league, Rich Gannon was watching film with him and said, what do you see on this film? And Mark was like, the defense. And he started going through everything you're supposed to be watching on the film. Right. So I don't – people blame Coach Eberflus and Waldron for the whole film story. I blame the plan. Where is the veteran who has to help him learn how to watch film?
Well, that's it. You talk about Sanchez. That's what Lawrence was calling for the whole season and the offseason. And now here's Case Keenum. So
right.
Somebody did teach Mark Sanchez how to watch film.
That's what
film.
I'm saying. So it's a whole group of people saying, okay, look, this is how you play quarterback, right? We don't snap the ball late on a jet sweep in the preseason, right? We have to learn how to snap that ball from under center. It's a tough thing to learn when you didn't do a lot of it like you're talking about. So I'm waiting to like midseason this year and see if he's controlling the line of scrimmage, doing the things he's got to do. If you watch just from – I mean, I think we'll see very similar game plans this week with Minnesota and the Bears. With J.J. McCarthy and Caleb Williams. And we'll see outside zone and we see boots and we'll see layered concepts and we'll see them tackling one side of the field and both teams trying to protect their quarterback and give them easy reads.
All right, we got more. That is like that's an education. Like that last 15 minutes was just an absolute education from Olin Krutz. We got more.
Chat GPT.
Just type in what you need. And Olin's got more. The
most of the podcasts I listen to, I swear they're just Chat GPT.
You might be right.
You know what I mean? Like they're just giving you stats. Like I was listening to a podcast the other day. I'm not going to say which one because I'll
go ahead, man.
No, I won't. I won't do it.
All right. It was take.
I was doing my research, but I was like, "Gosh, like they could just get ChatGPT to do what this guy is doing, right? Just numbers and anyway."
So, look, we're gonna ask Olin some more questions because he knows what he's talking about. After a quick timeout,
I want to know how his life is changing with the return of these island games tonight, and we're here kind of celebrating the league as a whole as well.
It's pretty wild. We are at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Performance Studio. We are brought to you by PNC Bank and your local Ford dealers. We have a great crowd here that's just hanging on every word.
Tommy, good morning. How you doing?
Hey, good morning, guys. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing well.
Apparently, we're trying to get you another job. I mean, we like you in the job you have. Are you hearing from other teams? Are you interested in anything like that? What are your thoughts on it?
No, I mean, obviously, we're focused on what we got to do this year and do some really fun things. And we've tried to build up. Like, you know, people have asked me over the years, like, if that's something I've ever, you know, thought about and managing. And you know, honestly, I love the pitching side of things. I love being able to help guys get better on this side of the ball. It's definitely something I'd entertain, you know, down the road. But, I mean, I just love the pitching side. I love being able to you know, help guys improve. I love giving up zeros. I love putting zeros on the scoreboard. It's, like, probably my favorite thing in the world. You know, and I want to be able to keep doing that right now.
You've been with the Cubs since December 2014. That makes you one of the more longstanding members of the organization. I can't imagine many who have been there longer, Tommy, and you've served a variety of roles. So while we ask you about, you know, the manager question, I wonder if the front office awaits you at some point in time. Nobody's trying to get rid of you now because you're valuable in this role. We love the mound visits and all the things that you do for this staff, but is a front office a possibility down the road?
Yeah, you know, I don't ever – I'm a very present person. I'll just say that. I really dive into what I'm working on, you know, right now. And I'm always thinking about the future and, like, what I want to do. But I live in the present a lot, especially in this job. You have to. You can't get too far ahead. You have to be very present. You have to be very present for your players and trying to do what's best for, you know, for them, for the organization, for the team. And then things that come down the road, I think that what Council said, it's something I just believe. If you work hard and you do what you need to do and you focus on the right things, like opportunities present themselves, it's what I talk to our players about, too. And I think that's a motto that we kind of live by. You know, for me, I've just been very fortunate to be in this organization for as long as I've had. Around some of the best baseball minds, I think, in the game, coming up with, you know, Theo Epstein drafted me in Boston in 2004. I was able to be around him and Jed even in Boston before we got to Chicago. But being around those guys and being around some of the great coaches that we had prior to, you know, my tenure as a coach, I learned a ton. I learned and I grew as a person and as a baseball person. And I think that helps shape, you know, who you want to be as a coach and as a just a baseball, you know, mind, I guess, in general. I've been very fortunate to be around some great people in my career.
Speaking of presents, have you picked one out for Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce? And will you be attending their nuptials?
We were joking because in San Fran, we had the off day before the San Fran series, and I flew my wife out to San Fran so we could go up to Napa, you know, to enjoy the off day. It was a great trip. But I joked because the picture looked like it was taken in Napa. And so that was my joke that I was there. I took the picture for the Angel photo. So, but no, but it's crazy. It's just, there's so much going on, you know, and this is my favorite time of year with, you know, playoff baseball, September baseball, football starting up. You know, there's just so many storylines and things going on, and that's obviously a big one in Kansas City right now.
Well, we'll get to the pitching stuff in a moment, but do you have a record, a projected record for the Chiefs, and who was the best player on your fantasy football team?
Well, they're going to win 13 games because that's Taylor Swift's number, you know, so that's kind of like the running joke, you know, they'll win 13 in the regular season, which, you know, 13-4 would be a, you know, pretty good.
You take,
you know,
that
pretty good record in season. And then, you know, in fantasy, I have a dynasty league that I've been in for a long time with a lot of my family and stuff. And those are so fun because you draft young guys, you get to keep them, you get to, you know, hold on to people for a long time. You're going to make trades that aren't just for a season. You're going to be holding guys for a while. And I've just done a lot of really good managing that I have, you know, like Justin Jefferson and Puka and Mahomes and, like, some, you know, my running backs are like Saquon Barkley and, wow. You know, I've got a solid dynasty team. I'm pretty proud of it.
Sure. Solid dynasty team.
You can run a football team,
yeah,
too.
That sounds pretty good. So, Tommy, help us out. We're talking about where you guys are at, what's going on. Is Jameson Taillon back soon? I saw Michael Soroka had a 34-pitch. I don't know if it was how you'd term it, but is he back too? What are we expecting as the month continues here?
Yeah, I think for JMO, starting with him, he's been progressing well, feeling good. He threw a bullpen on Monday. He's going to throw for Iowa tomorrow. So hopefully that goes well. He comes out of that with no issues, and then we'd be, you know, obviously talking about getting him back. And we didn't think this was going to be something that was going to linger and keep him out for an extended period of time. But again, until you go out and test it in a game environment, so it'll give you a better indication of how things are. But I feel good about where JMO is,
and hopefully that, you know, everything goes well tomorrow. We'll be talking about getting him back next week. And then for Michael, you know, live BP went really well yesterday, kind of two-inning simulated live BP. Goal would be to try to repeat that again on Saturday and then look at, you know, probably, a rehab assignment next week. And then, again, same kind of thing, then evaluating, see if he's ready to kind of step back. And you know, using these live BPs to get guys work and continue to build their workload, to continue to work on some mechanical tweaks and things that, you know, he and us wanted to focus on while keeping him active, I think is important. And he looked really good yesterday. Obviously, we need to see how he recovers today.
So I think Javi Assad was one of those guys you weren't quite sure what to expect from once he got here, if he ever got there, to help. And yet I think he's emerged as somebody as reliable as you might have hoped. How would you describe his path this year? The waiting. And then when he finally gets here, because of roster configuration and the way you can maneuver it, he was sent down and brought up, and he's had a lot of back and forth. But, Tommy, it seems like he's been as consistent as you would want.
Yeah, I think when you say, you know, we didn't really know what to expect with Javi, is like, you know, we may not have, but Javi knows what to expect, you know, with himself. He is confident. He's calm. He's poised. He can do whatever you want him to do. He's, for me, like a dream to coach, to be able to work with, because he'll do a lot of different things, and he doesn't shy away from any challenge you give him. And one big challenge for Javi this year was the injuries and something that he had to deal with, you know, throughout the beginning of spring training, and then had a little setback. But it just shows you the type of person that Javi is and the resiliency that he has. And he knew he was going to help this team in a big way. And one thing I'll give him credit for is he didn't rush it. You see a lot of guys that try to come back from injury quick because they want to get back and help the team. They want to prove that they can do it. And Javi, you know, after that, I think that first setback, he's like, okay, I need to get this right. I need to take my time. I need to do what's best for me and for the team. And now we're seeing him, you know, have success, and we're seeing the fruits of kind of the labor that he's put in. So amazing. Obviously, Javi's an amazing person. He's fun to work with. He's going to play a big role on our team the rest of this way. There's a lot of different ways that we can utilize a guy that, with his talents, obviously starting or even in a longer relief bullpen role, like in the postseason.
We've asked you before about Cade Horton and the plan for him moving forward with the number of innings and all that. This guy has just been going from strength to strength. It seems like he's getting better and better every time out. Are you surprised at how effortlessly he makes it look?
No, I mean, not really. I think he's such a good competitor. He's such a you know, a strong-minded individual. And this is a great example and something I think for coaches in particular. It's like you challenge a player with something, he's going to go out there and prove that he can do it and do it at a high level. And I think one thing with Cade, what people have seen was we've obviously limited his pitch count. We talked about, you know, making sure he understands our goal is to keep him fresh and peaking at the end of the season. So, you know, talking to him about having some shorter outings where we limit his pitches, you know, to help, you know, save some of those bullets for later in the season, he took that as a challenge. Like, all right, well, if you're only going to give me 75 pitches, I'm going to try to go seven innings, you know? And it's crazy how many outings he's had at 70 to 75 pitches that he's gone six innings. That, in the big leagues, in the best league, you know, that there is. And he took that as a challenge. That just kind of tells you the type of person that he is. He sees that as like, all right, I want to go as deep as I can. I'm going to attack the strike zone. That's been really fun to see with Cade. There's going to be more punch in there too. There's going to be more strikeouts. There's going to be more opportunities to get swing and miss. And he sees it as like, I'm good enough to beat people in zone. And then when I need to get the strikeouts, I'm going to have the ability to do so. That's a good combination for the Cubs for sure.
Tommy, you guys claim Aaron Civale from the White Sox. It's his third team this year. The ink was barely dry on his contract, and he was in the game trying to keep the the game close, and he did just that. How do you approach a guy like that who's a veteran, who's had a lot of voices in his head this year, and he arrives and all of a sudden he's on the mound pitching for you?
Yeah, number one, it's anything you want to do in situations like that is you first and foremost have to sit and talk to the player, have to get their take on where they are in the kind of timeline of the season. We sat and talked with Aaron the first day, you know, he came in, and we just gave him the floor, like, just download to us, like, tell us where you're at. Because a lot of players will come in like, all right, what do you guys see? What do you want me to do? And I'm much more on the side of, like, you tell me what's been going on. I don't want to assume anything. I want you to download to me where you're at. And then a lot of the things that we want to, as an organization, to kind of like push will come up organically in those conversations. So you give him the opportunity, we talk about it. Obviously, he's a guy that's had success in the major leagues, has had prior success, has had great years as a starter, and obviously a guy we want to use in the bullpen right now to give us some multiple innings. So yeah, I think right away we wanted to see where he was, wanted to just continue to help him push what his strengths are right now, and lean on those pretty heavily while trying to find those little nuggets that we can work on over the, you know, next few weeks as well. So yeah, it was a great game. He did fantastic. I think that was a really good lineup. I mean, a really tough lineup. The Braves have a strong lineup, and he was able to navigate it really well with all those lefties. It was impressive to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of wild. You know, you had to go out, David mentioned the mound visit. You had to go out and talk to Daniel Palencia. He worked around a couple of singles in the ninth. That's his 22nd save. How is he doing? I know you've used him in some non-save situations. The one was weird because it seemed like he was throwing his secondary stuff and gave up a few consecutive singles on his off-speed stuff. And the guy throws, like, so fast. You just wonder about that. How is he doing? How are you doing with him?
Yeah, Palencia is doing amazing. Like, he's been such it's just been so fun to see Danny grow over the last two seasons. To see a guy who, you know, had a 17% walk rate last year, and even when he was in, like, Triple A last year, it was like 12-13%. Now it's in the big leagues in 50 innings and 22 saves. He's got a 7% walk rate, 28% punch rate. He's learned what he needs to do to be successful. He's learned that his stuff plays at a high clip in zone. And when you do that with the electric stuff he has, yes, occasionally you're going to give up hits. No matter what way you look at it. And what Danny has shown, what's been great, is he's not afraid of contact, and that's huge. In the back end of a bullpen, how many times have we seen over years that teams have guys that they'll pitch around people and walk? You know, we have closers and guys in the back end with 12, 13, 14% walk rates. Those are ones that, you know, we try to avoid, and I think Danny's done a great job with that. He knows he's got an electric fastball, but he also knows he has to be able to mix in the off-speed when he needs to. And I think what we've seen with Danny, the one thing in his growth this year, the arc of his success, has been when we have the lead, like last night, when we're up one, he pitches to win the game. And he has an aggression to him, and he has the ability to attack the strike zone and come after hitters and get ahead. And at times, you know, it's normal for younger guys to go through the experience of pitching in a tie game where you kind of try to pitch not to lose versus pitching to win, and that's something I think Danny's learned over the last few weeks, is that, you know, even in a tie ball game, you know, I need to keep my mentality the way it is when we're ahead and pitching to win the game. And again, that's just part of the growth pattern for Danny growing in that role. And then we talk, and I just want to say one other thing about the closer thing, because we talk mm-hmm. about this every year in spring training, right? Who's the closer going to be this year? And I always believe that, like, closers are born. I mean, they're not born, but they're, like, grown into as the season goes on. And Danny has proven that he can do it at a high clip, you know, in that role. Since he's been given the opportunity, I think he's got the third most saves since, you know, we put him in that role in the big leagues. And that's saying a lot for what he's done this year.
it makes me feel better hearing you talk about Daniel Palencia than I felt watching him last night, because there, when he gives up a couple hits, you get a little skittish sometimes. But the way you just described it, I guess it feels, you feel more confident understanding how far he has come and what to really look for.
He's, I mean, he's cut his walk rate for, you know, over half, you know, from where it was last year. If he knows if he's going to get beat, he's going to make sure that the other team beats him. He's going to lose a couple balls. He's going to throw one to the backstop, you know, from El Ozuna in a bat like he did last night. But he's making adjustments. That's the difference. It's not taking Danny a hitter or two to find those adjustments. He's doing it pitch to pitch now, and that, I think that's the thing for me. I'm so proud of the way he's grown.
Great stuff, Tommy. Good luck today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tommy.
Of course. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
We are back. My next guest, of course, played Bobby Bacala on The Sopranos. Please welcome Steve Sciarrippa.
Steve Sciarrippa in the booth with us.
I got booked by Steve Sciarrippa at the Riviera. It was one of the first times I ever worked in Vegas.
He's an incredible guy. Steve Sciarrippa.
Bobby Bacalieri, the last man standing.
To the victor belongs to spoils.
What are you looking at?
I'm in awe of you.
You were gone a long time. How many White Castle did you have?
I didn't, I swear.
I can smell them.
And you, lay off the Snapple.
You want to play Santa Claus at the party this year?
Nah, I can't do that.
Why not?
I'm shy.
The boss and his family told you you're going to be Santa Claus. You're Santa Claus.
Shyness is a curse. Quasimodo predicted all this.
Who did what?
And to waste my votes on somebody like Dick Hoffman, I might as well put a bullet in my head. Here, here, and here. All these problems, the Middle East, the end of the world.
Nostradamus.
Karen Seedy. It's the last one she made.
Quasimodo's the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
All right. Nostradamus.
Nostradamus.
It's not bad enough you wake me in the middle of the night. I gotta get my balls broken too?
Go with my nephew. Do what he says.
Maybe it would help you if you got shot.
What are you talking about? Got shot.
Make you more popular too. You know, raise your profile with X-Lax. Something easy. The fleshy part of the thigh. I'm a marksman. Sit down. This is a Giants house.
I hate the Giants.
Oh! You're
throwing all this right in the garbage.
It's my hobby, Janice. Why are you gonna belittle it?
You probably don't even hear it when it happens, right? It's your friend in there.
A
wall.
You never see a blue comet in that condition. Imagine riding in that club car, sipping on a Negroni.
Spiegel and Holmes.
I have a famous wiener dog.
Okay.
Named Willy Boy.
Afternoons on The Score.
We are in front of a big crowd here who saw Steve Sciarrippa's face pop up on the Twitch stream, and this is great. We are in the Blue Cross Blue Shield Performance Studio, brought to you by PNC Bank and your local Ford dealers. It's the Spiegel and Holmes Show here with you until 6 o'clock. Dave Wannstedt will be in studio with us at 5. Right now, though, you can check this guy out. He's going to be at the Athenaeum. I don't know why I can't. I'm now stuck on that.
Athenaeum.
Thank you.
You got it.
I've been there multiple times. It's a wonderful place to see a show.
It really is. We just saw Roy Wood there together.
Yeah, Roy Wood was awesome last summer there. And that's where Steve Sciarrippa is going to be. And so we are so happy to welcome him onto The Score. And Steve, we appreciate you jumping on. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, man. Thanks for having me. How are you guys doing? All right?
Yeah, man, we're good. See, you got to understand, this is a show that references The Sopranos an absurd amount. Because our sound guy, our brilliant Chris Tannehill, we play a game called Categories, and sometimes he loses on purpose, Steve, so we can just relax, and he turns on an old Sopranos episode, sits around and watches that. That's a true story. And we talked about it yesterday, because there was this news story with Kawhi Leonard having a $28 million no-show job that he had in the NBA to circumvent the salary cap. So Tanny played a whole bunch of no-show job clips from Sopranos episodes.
It's hilarious. And, you know, I would have thought, you know, there's so much better ways to hide the money than what they did. I mean, it's very easy to get caught the way they did it, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, how would you suggest hiding the money, Steve Sciarrippa? How would Bobby Bacala hide it?
I would have paid his wife, his nephew, his cousin. I mean, there's so many different ways to hide the money. You could do it in different portions. And, I mean, there's a million ways to do it. You know, I'll tell you a funny thing about Kawhi Leonard. His agent, I went to high school with.
Wow.
No way.
Mitch Frankel, I think it's still his agent. Well, he's a good guy.
Well,
yeah, I went to high school with him. We played JV basketball. Yeah, Mitch was a hell of a good ball player. Good guy.
You think, is he having a tough day? Tough moment?
I have not spoke to him. I don't know.
We might want to check in on him. It could be a tough moment. I mean, for Mitch.
It wasn't his fault. Who's to blame? The owner of the team, if you're going to blame anybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Forget about it.
Go to the top. Go to the top.
Steve, what type of ball player were you?
I played in college, Division III basketball. I was pretty good.
Wow.
I could play. I played in the guard in my senior year. Then I played. I lived in Vegas for many years. So I played with all those guys, Larry Johnson. And I know Greg Anthony since he was in high school, and Ricky Sobers. And there was one place to play in town, which is, I'm not joking, it was called the Sporting House. It is now Sapphire's Strip Club. That is where everyone played, and you had everybody there. All the UNLV Rebels, all the guys, if they would come to town, they would play, and it was some great, great runs there. Yeah.
Who's the best famous, like, actor ball player that you've played with?
Woody Harrelson thinks he's good, but he was no good. He played with us. No good at all. He thinks he's good. Uh-huh. I think Adam Sandler's okay when he was younger. I think David Duchovny could play a little bit.
Did you ever play at Larry Sanders' house? Larry Sanders used to have
used to have a game, but yeah. I don't know if they were any good. I mean, Sarah Silverman was in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, she could be good. I mean, I don't know. I like Sarah. I like them all, but
yeah,
they used to play on Sundays there. I don't know. Woody Harrelson really thought he could play. He's a way better actor than he is ball player.
And of course, I meant Gary Shandling, who played Larry Sanders. But yeah, those were legendary games. So we're going to Vegas in a couple of weeks. Our good friends at Circa are bringing us to Vegas. And I didn't realize you were the talent booker at the Riviera for a long time. Is that true? That's insane. Who's some of the big acts that you booked at the Riviera at the time?
Dennis Leary, Bill Maher, Richard Belzer, Rosie O'Donnell. That piece of garbage, Ellen DeGeneres, David Spade, Rob Schneider, George Lopez. We could go down the line. Ray Romano, Kevin James, Drew Carey.
Wow.
You've
had a few different lives there.
Well, that's how I started acting. You know, I was booking the comics, and then Bruce Baum, Kevin Pollak put me in a couple of their HBO special and Fox special, and kind of got the acting bug, took some lessons, started auditioning, and that's kind of how it all started, you know, like that. But it was those guys. I worked with comic Bruce Baum, and he was very helpful for me at the beginning. And, you know, then I just started taking it from there. And then I came to New York for a wedding, and I auditioned for The Sopranos.
When you're in Sopranos, while it's going on, not looking back, did you know that you guys had struck gold with the cultural importance of the show? Like, it just seems like the acting was so good on every level that it would have been hard to not believe that it was going to be a success.
Well, you know, if you talk to the guys that were there from day one, I mean, I came on the second season. If you talk to Michael and Jim, used to tell me, and nobody knew that. You know, Michael even thought it was a farce, like it was a comedy. He didn't even know what to think of it, you know, on paper. And Jim figured he'd just do the pilot, make some money, and move on. He didn't think it was going to be a hit. And then the reviews came out, and they were the most glowing reviews that you could ever get. It was, like, incredible. They were saying it was the greatest thing in pop culture ever, and on and on and on, all these big publications. Now, by the time I got there, I remember early on I was shooting. I happened to be shooting that day, and that's the day they were the first cable show to be nominated. 16 Emmy nominations. It was the first cable show, and it got nominated for 16 shows, and that kind of took it to a whole nother level. You know, and so as you're doing it, you know it's really good stuff, really good material. It's just kind of incredible. you know, you're looking forward to getting the script. It's that good, you know. So as time went on, it took a little while, but, you know, don't forget, they shot that first season. Nobody even knew who they were, you know.
It's amazing.
They're shooting on the streets and nobody knew who they were.
It really like kind of kicks off this entire era of prestige TV on cable and on HBO, and the whole concept of the anti-hero, which was not like a brand new thing, but really building a show around it. Because then you get Breaking Bad, you get even shows like The Shield, and like other shows started to pop up where the anti-hero was the thing. You're a sports fan. You're a sports guy. Do you root for the anti-heroes? You root for the bad guys who are great, or do you root for the good guys who are nice and clean, seemingly?
Bad guys in what way? Poor performers or bad people?
Bad people. Like they're human.
So Dennis Rodman? Dennis Rodman?
They're human flaws. Their frailty is obvious, like Tony's was. You know what I mean? Do you root for those people?
Listen, I think Tony Soprano, he didn't look like a TV star at all, right? Here he is, the star of the biggest show. He doesn't look like that. Usually it's a slick, good-looking guy. Here's an overweight, balding guy. Looks much older than what he is, but yet he's a tremendous actor. He's a terrible... Tony Soprano is a terrible person. He does everything under the sun. He kills people. He steals. He does drugs. He gambles. He, cheats on his wife. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yet we want this guy to succeed. We want root for this guy. We love this guy. And I think that's mostly in the performance, of course, and the writing.
I guess what I'm asking is if you're an Aaron Rodgers fan.
You know what? Believe it or not, I'm not a football fan. I'm a big Yankee fan, a big Knick fan. I don't follow football. I just don't. Even though I got a movie coming out in December, Hallmark movie with the Buffalo Bills. We shot in Highmark Stadium, which was a lot of fun. But I don't know. Aaron Rodgers is kind of an ass, right? I don't know.
Nailed it.
That's what I read.
Way to play to the Chicago crowd, Steve. You nailed that. Killed it.
Listen. Whatever.
Steve, if you say that to the crowd that you'll have Saturday night, I promise you, you'll get a standing ovation. Okay. I promise you.
I mean, you know, you got a lot of these guys. I mean, you know, it's like actors too, where you go, I could separate the, you know, the actor from the person. Like Robert De Niro, I used to be a big fan. He's one of the biggest jackoffs you'll ever meet in your life. Okay? And it has nothing to do with his politics. He's a complete jackoff. He's a bad guy, and people all around him know he's a bad guy, but yet everyone thinks he's this tough guy from Goodfellas, and I can't separate. So I cannot watch a Robert De Niro film anymore, you know? And it's got nothing to do with his politics. I it's him, you know?
So you being a Knicks fan the way that you were, where were you on Michael Jordan? He had a pretty good run in this town. We kind of enjoyed him a little bit.
Well, Michael Jordan's one of the greatest players, if not the greatest player ever. He's a very bad tipper. I lived in Vegas. We called him Hoarding Michael Jordan. And we called Scotty No Pippin Tippin.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that.
Well, the Scotty one we knew about, that's been legend around here, No Tippin' Pippin'. But Hoarding Michael Jordan, that's a new one.
Hoarding Michael Jordan, you don't want to share. Tiger Woods is the worst tipper of them all. Oh. Tiger Woods is the absolute worst tipper. Ask any cocktail waitress, dealer, anyone in Las Vegas. Tips no one ever, ever.
Wow. He and the cocktail waitresses had a different way of... of transferring equity, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, what do you got? You got what? He's baffled that I said Hoarding Michael Jordan. It's sacrilegious. You can't talk bad about him.
No, you can say whatever you want. It's your segment, Steve. You're good.
Steve, I have to ask you about maybe your most important role. And that's as Carmine on Star Trek Enterprise with the incredible Golden Brooks. I saw that episode a couple days ago and I was like, man, I love that episode. It's alien Nazis that they're fighting against.
Wait, yeah, so help me with this. There's alien Italians against alien Nazis? No, what are we talking about?
No, it's
we were freedom fighters. I was a freedom fighter.
Wow.
He was a freedom fighter, and like some of the aliens joined up with the Nazis to try to change the future. And Steve and his crew, Carmine and the crew, were there fighting the good fight against them. It was pretty awesome, man. I love seeing you in that genre. So what was it like to kind of get into like the Star Trek family?
Well, listen, first of all, I was hoping to be an alien. That's what I was hoping when they offered me the role. And then I was a freedom fighter. I was there for 3 weeks on the Paramount lot. It was a real lot of fun. Scott Bakula, a really good guy. I've never seen an episode of Star Trek in my life. But I had a lot of fun there. I mean, we were shooting the guns all night, and I drove that Jeep really through the fence. That was for real. And it was a lot of fun. And I got into a little beef with one of the aliens, but Scott Bakula got between us. One of the aliens, if you look, and the makeup guy showed me, they designed it to look like Paulie Walnuts. One of the aliens on that show had the wings like Paulie Walnuts.
Oh my God, you're right. Wow. I never even thought of that.
That's so cool. What a great homage that is. That's all. Hey, is that a picture of the Pine Barrens episode behind you over there? Stuck in the forest? Is that what that is?
Yeah, there's Pine Barrens. There's the choo-choo hat, the train, which I still have. That's my first day on set, me, Jim, and Dominic Chianese. That's my first day.
Wow.
This is a movie we did, Nikki Deuce. It's one of Jim's last movies. Michael Imperioli's in it. Paulie Walnuts, Johnny Sack, they're all in it. I wrote the book. It's a kid's book. What's that? U2, Bono. Matt Damon, and that's with Clint Eastwood.
No De Niro. No De Niro up there.
There's no De Niro pictures. I do have a Sinatra.
I heard mixed stories about Sinatra, I'll be honest.
He was good to me the times I've met him. I mean, we weren't friends, but I've met him numerous times. He was good to me, but I've heard mixed stories also.
Amazing.
This has been really cool. So what can people expect Saturday night? They come out to see you guys. Well, what are they going to get?
I'll say, so it's called, you know, we had a podcast, big podcast, Talking Sopranos, but this is a show. It's myself, Michael Imperioli. We have a great comic, Joey Cola. We show clips and slides. We tell very funny behind the scenes stories. Only people there would know, me and Michael, all true stories. All comedy oriented, you know, how we got the job, auditions, talk about Jim, Paulie Walnuts. We do a Q&A. We do a meet and greet at the end. If you're a Soprano fan, it's a must. We've done it all over the country. Sometimes Vinny Pastore would be with us. He will not be here this one. We've toured Australia. We've got a big UK tour coming up in February. We've sold over 17,000 tickets. We've never been over there. But it's a real lot of fun. And like I said, we tell you stuff that went on. Sometimes people ask great questions from the audience. You can't stump us. We got an answer to everything. And I'm surprised you guys aren't there if you're a big Soprano fan.
Well, we'll see. I bet some of us will. I bet some of us will be.
That's... I mean, it really is a lot of fun. We've played every major city. We've never done Chicago. I think we were booked here, then COVID kind of screwed things up. So it's our first time in Chicago. We're looking forward to it. The comic is great. He comes out. He does 15 minutes. And then it's me and Michael.
There you go. Hey, Steve, let's do this again, like a Bulls-Knicks week. Something like that in the season, all right?
Let's do it. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, you think the Knicks could win this whole thing?
I think they're still a little short. No pun intended.
You think there's something missing?
But they're good.
We love Tibbs. We love Tibbs. We didn't like seeing Tibbs get treated like that at the end.
Listen, he's walked away with $30 million. There's a reason. Whatever it is, and I don't know what that is, there's some reason he walked. Something with the players, maybe. I don't know, but he'll be okay. He could cry on a bag of $30 million.
Steve, you're the absolute best. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
See you guys. I hope you see us Saturday night. Come on out. It's a great show. There's a handful of tickets left.
That's Steve Sharippa. Go see him at the Athenaeum Theater. 2936 North Southport. Doors open at 7. The show is at 8. Joey Cola is going to open. It's going to be awesome. And if that's a preview of what you're getting, man, oh, man.
You know, it's just another sports show doing the natural pivot from Olin Krutz to Steve Sharippa. You know what I'm saying?
I think that we stayed very true to the honesty of our guests between Olin and Steve Sharippa.
I think we did.